Thank you all for coming this afternoon. On a nice day, I'd rather be outside myself. It feels very strange to be talking in the Red Room, as opposed to sitting listening to somebody else talk. I don't know how many classes I sat in one of those seats for, but they were some of the best classes that I had, and I'm sure many of you have those memories as well. I'm going to talk to you this afternoon. My talk comes from a book I wrote a few years ago called Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. The talk I've pulled out of that is called, as you can see, The Houses of the Fiction. And I'm going to talk about houses, about James and houses, and about the different buildings, both real and imaginary, that play a role in the story, or rather the stories, of The Portrait of a Lady, his first real masterpiece, a book from 1881. I say stories because there are really two of them, as indeed James himself said. First, there's the story of the book, how he came to write it, what he did while he was working on it, how it was published in 1881 and its effect on his personal and professional lives, and then of how many years later he triumphantly revised it. And then there's the story in the book. The story of the book, the story in the book. That is the story of Isabel Archer, an American girl set loose in Europe, whom we watch as she makes the choices, or rather the mistakes, that she insists on making. But both those stories have to do with houses, and so I'm going to move back and forth between the work and the life, between the literal and the textual presence of a few particular houses. And I'm going to begin with a metaphor, maybe James's most famous metaphor. It's a few lines from the preface to The Portrait of a Lady that he wrote in 1906, 25 years after the book was first published. It's a description of what he calls the house of fiction, a house that has, in short, not one window, but a million. A number of possible windows not to be reckoned, rather, every one of which has been pierced by the need of the individual vision and by the pressure of the individual will. It's like some enormous apartment building inhabited entirely by writers who stand at the different windows, windows of different shapes and sizes, broad or balconied or slit-like and low-browed. And through those windows, they gaze out at the world around them. The different shapes of those openings work to determine the scope and angle of their vision, all of them watching a part of the same show, but each of them making something different out of it. But anyone who's read The Portrait of a Lady will know that houses are never just metaphors. They're a guide to character and a motive for action. At times, they can even seem like characters themselves. I'm going to look at three houses today, three places that each have a role in my story. One is Lamb House. It's on the south coast of England. It's a place to which James moved in 1898, where he wrote the words I've just quoted. The second is a country house named Hardwick in the Thames Valley. It's the original of Gardencourt, where the novel begins. And the third is a villa in Florence where James puts his villain, Gilbert Osmond. It's modeled on what's, oops, extra picture. That's out of focus because I took it. This is the Florentine villa. The third is a villa where he puts his villain, Gilbert Osmond. It's modeled on what's called the Villa Castellani. In each case, that house is going to give us some sense of how Henry James worked. So, Lamb House. Many years later, he would remember the way the book had begun. He was old then, and in England. At home in the place he had made for himself, a brick 18th century house in the small Sussex town of Rye. It was a marsh country known for its shipwrecks and smugglers, 30 miles down the channel from Dover. An odd place for an American novelist, and an odder one for a man whose habits were all of them urban. A man of clubs and cabs, of dinner parties and first nights. He was a famous man, with elaborate manners and kind, yet someone whose eyes could seem to drill your spine with their knowledge. Famous. But now too little read, as his royalty figures all too often reminded him. Sometimes he joked about how little his books brought in. His good friend Edith Wharton, for example, she might sell enough to buy a new car. His own checks, he claimed, they'd only cover the cost of a wheelbarrow. He had been in Europe for 30 years. It had been the great adventure of his life. Or rather, it had made other adventures possible, the adventure contained in the litter of printed sheets on his desk. His agent had taken two copies of one of his novels and cut their bindings, and then pasted each page onto a larger sheet. Now he had a single unbound copy with a few inches of white space on either side of the page, plenty of room to scrawl. He dipped his pen and blackened half a line of type. He wrote four words in the margin and then drew a circle around them with a faint thread of ink, tethering them to their place in his paragraph. He blotted two more lines. He got rid of a character's name and substituted the words, "our friend." He italicized a word of dialogue. Now, most 19th century novelists touched up their work in the months between its first publication in a magazine and its appearance as a bound volume. I say that because almost all important 19th century fiction in Britain especially, had a serial publication. It appeared as short stories in magazines, as serialized novels, and then it would come out as a bound volume. A serial installment might have been rushed to meet a deadline, trimmed to match the available space. But James took the business of revision much further than that. He lived in a world of second thoughts. He thought that almost every one of his sentences could stand a little work. He could hardly bear to reread his earlier things, except with a pen in his hand, making changes as he went, even when those changes were for his eyes only. The sheets on his desk were from a book he'd written a quarter of a century ago, The Portrait of a Lady, in 1880-81. It was the novel in which, after a long and careful apprenticeship, he had first allowed his imagination full stretch. It had been his first true success. And though as a young man he had made fun of the idea of the great American novel, greatness had always been in his mind. He had taken pains with this book. It had changed his reputation. It had made him important enough to be attacked. And now it was to have a new life. So James was in his 60s now. And he was thinking about the future. Not so much his own personal future as the future of his work, the face he was going to present to posterity. So he'd arranged for the publication of a definitive edition of his fiction, which he called the New York edition. He called it that because that's where he'd been born. The early books that had made his name, things like Daisy Miller, The Portrait Itself, they would have their surfaces retouched, their style nudged into line with that of his later work. Some of those revisions proved extensive, on this book in particular, something different in almost every paragraph. And to each volume, James planned to add a preface, a frank, critical talk about its subject, its origin, its place. So in the evenings, he took up his old pages. Mornings were for new work, three concentrated hours that began around 10. Now, in the spring of 1906, that meant a travel book called The American Scene. It's based upon his recent visit to the United States, his first in 25 years. Almost every corner of Lamb House gave him a space in which to write. But in warm weather, his favorite was a place called the Garden Room. It was detached from the house itself. It was a studio that he entered from his acre of walled garden. Unfortunately, it no longer stands. Lamb House was in the flight path of the German bombers in World War II, and a bomb took out the studio. So if you visit it today, and you can, it's owned by the National Trust, you'll just find the outline of that studio laid out in brick on the grass. Old photographs show the room as uncluttered, almost as though cleared for action. It was a room big enough and open enough for James to pace. his left thumb tucked in his waistcoat armhole, his hesitant and at times stammering voice gaining in assurance as it rolled from sentence to sentence. And as he talked, his voice would be answered by the sputter and clack of a Remington typewriter. Because he wasn't alone in that room. He shared it with a young woman from a London secretarial agency whom he'd hired to take down his dictation. James had been dictating for almost a decade by this point. 30 years of his own, almost entirely illegible handwriting. I know, I've tried to read the letters in manuscript. It's bad. They cramped his hand. He now saved it as much as he could. Dictation made concision impossible. The speaking voice let him stretch his sentences out with one qualification after another. But he liked having a clean page on which to revise. And by now, the typewriter's noise provided an aid to concentration. So did an occasional cigarette. That was the morning. Then lunch and a walk through Rye's grassy cobbled streets. A few hours to cover a few miles. His way broken by the small talk of a small town. A chat with neighbors. A greeting to the fishmonger. And in the early evening, he sat down to his revisions. For as he himself wrote, the time from 5 until 8 can be a little eternity. And with a soft summer light holding back the dusk, I like to think of him as spending that time in the garden room, in the pleasure and slow care of his work. There's an hour yet before dinner, and his pen scratches over the page, each sheet marked by a delta of wavy lines, each stream attached to a lake of new words. He's near the end. And he blackens out a phrase, puts an extra degree of effusion into a character's voice, allows his heroine a sentence of struggling comprehension. And now he's pleased. He's mended some infelicities, clarified his character's motives. He's stretched and strengthened the metaphoric fibers of his prose. And when James began to talk his way through the novel's preface, he found a kind of romance in recovering the days of its origin. He would sit in thought while his typist waited at her keys. Then he was on his feet and the past was in his hands. First came the memory of Florence in the spring where he'd begun the novel in a hotel room over the Arno, the little buildings of the Ponte Vecchio virtually at his feet. Then Venice the following year. The memory of how the ceaseless human chatter came in at my windows, to which I seemed to myself to have been drawn, constantly drawn in the fruitless fidget of composition. It's as though the happy sail of the right word might lie there out in the blue. He paces, pauses, and a sentence floats on the air, a memory of the single small cornerstone with which he had begun, the conception of a certain young woman affronting her destiny. His heroine had stood there all alone in his mind, unsupported at first by friends or family or any shred of a narrative. And then one morning he woke up knowing who all his other characters would be. And Henry James set himself to the job of organizing an ado about Isabel Archer.
2.
Garden Court. Now those of you who've read the novel, and how many people here have read that book? So about a third, maybe. Those of you who've read, and some more of you may have seen the movie, which is a Jane Campion movie from around 2000. Those of you who've read the novel, you might remember that we first see Isabel just after she arrives in Britain. She's been traveling from her home in upstate New York. She's standing in the doorway of an English country house and gathering herself to walk out onto the stage of her life, onto a lawn where she'll join a group gathered around a tea table. Now, a door is a door, and we don't need to see it symbolically to know that the act of walking through one can be momentous. It's an entrance, an instant of passage, of transition. But this particular door also provides a frame in which the girl stands as if for her portrait. The door isolates her. It gives her a border. It makes her a picture. As she pauses to look out at the scene before her, the shade trees and carpet of turf running down to the Thames. In every window of the house of fiction, there stands a watcher, the consciousness of the artist, who will make some meaning of the scene outside. So we can imagine ourselves as reading that scene over the artist's shoulder, our eyes following his. And we might also think of Isabel in that doorway as making up a story about the people she sees out in the lawn, a story about the world she's about to join. Perhaps, indeed, her very position in that doorway is one of the things that 25 years later would contribute to that metaphor of his. But leave that image aside. What about this house, this place that James called Garden Court? The house is owned by a family named Touchett. Mrs. Touchett is Isabel's aunt on her mother's side. Her husband, Daniel, though born in Vermont, he's made a great fortune as a London banker. The lawn outside has been furnished with rugs and chairs, books and tables, as though it were a room, as though Isabel were looking not outside, but in. It's a place of comfort and ease, and to read of it is to wish yourself a part of it. So Isabel can't help herself when her cousin Ralph Touchett murmurs the name of another guest as they walk across the lawn. "Oh, I hoped there would be a lord," she says. "It's just like a novel." Because Isabel has now stepped inside her own story. It's a story that comes with an English lord and a country house, a ghost, and even a palace in Rome. Comes with everything one wants a certain kind of novel to have. It's a gesture that welds Isabel's love of the props and furniture of fiction to her Anglophilia. It's a gesture that serves to license such guilty pleasures of our own. Now, we know that James had a particular young woman in mind as a model for Isabel. It's a first cousin of his named Minnie Temple, who died in her early 20s from tuberculosis. We know that because Minnie's friends recognized her in the character. They recognized her just as soon as the novel's first chapters appeared as a serial in the Atlantic Monthly. And when they wrote to James about it, he answered them and he admitted it. But he cautioned them against taking the character as a direct portrait of his cousin. Poor Minnie, he wrote, was essentially incomplete. And I've tried to make my young woman more rounded, more finished. She was incomplete because she had been ill, because her death, her early death, meant that she didn't have the chance to become the person whom time and experience might have made her into. She didn't have the chance that Isabel herself is going to have. Still, James's imagination of Isabel's career is in one sense an extrapolation from Minnie's family circumstances. In 1906, he suggested that a photographer take a picture of a particular house to use as a frontispiece for the revised version of the novel. A view of the English country house, I'm quoting, Hardwick, near Pangbourne, on the Thames, which I had vaguely and approximately in mind years ago for the opening of the portrait. The place belonged to a member of Parliament named Charles Rose, whom James had known since his early days in England. And in writing, the novelist remembered that he'd once stayed there with him. Now, an image of that house did indeed become the novel's frontispiece. But the details of any trip that James himself might have made there, they're now irrecoverable. No correspondence with Rose survives. James nowhere else mentions the place. Still, I'm going to posit a visit at some point in the second half of 1877. That was the year Rose took up residence, leasing the estate at first and then later buying it. In a letter, James mentioned dining with him in London that autumn. The novelist had only moved to Britain just a few months before, and he'd had few invitations to country houses as yet. But this one would have been apt to follow, as I'll show in a moment. It's a brick building of the Tudor period, quote, a good deal bruised and defaced in Cromwell's wars, and some 40 miles upstream from London. The words come from the novel, but the facts are confirmed by the architectural historian Nicholas Pevsner, and both writers note the irregularity of its bricks and gables. The house sits on a low rise above the river, the steep hill rising directly behind, and its view across the Thames to the hedged fields beyond. It's very little change from what it would have been in James's day. I spent a summer morning there a few years ago, drove down from Oxford through one impeccable village after another, swooping at last downhill into Whitchurch on Thames, turning into a narrow lane just before the river. The house was a mile on, and the fields along the way were filled not with sheep or cows, not with what you'd expect, but with hundreds of long-necked llamas, a neighbor's farm. Now, Hardwick still belongs to the Rose family, though the current owner was absent. And the estate's manager showed me over the house and grounds, showed me the library with its elaborately plastered ceiling from the time of Elizabeth I, the direction from which carriages would once have approached. It's surrounded by gravel walks, or avenues of old trees that channel one's vision down to the water. There's indeed a great spread of lawn on which you can imagine having tea. The Thames runs placidly here, and a 1906 article from Country Life claims that there's no more beautiful reach of the river than that upon which the Hardwick terraces look down. It isn't a grand house. It's not a powerhouse, not a place of lordly display. And yet it is a striking one, a substantial family home with 1,000 acres of mixed farming and timber. It's close to London, but marked with an enduring sense of privacy. Other estates along the Thames have a description and a history that can match it. But James had a particular reason for drawing on this one. Minnie Temple's mother, she'd been a James. She was the sister of the novelist's father, his first cousin. His first cousin on her mother's side. And Charles Rose, a London banker turned country squire, he was Minnie's first Temple on her father's side. James and Rose weren't related, but I guess you'd call them kin. First cousins of the same woman. Is that going to be okay still? Okay. So I'll trace the genealogy very briefly. The Temples came from Rutland, Vermont, Daniel Touchett's hometown. Robert Temple married Catherine James. They had 6 children, Minnie among them. In 1843, Robert's sister Charlotte, she married a Scottish-born Montreal lawyer named John Rose, who over the next 20 years would become one of Canada's most successful financiers. Rose returned to England in 1869. He set up a merchant bank that specialized in railroads, which were the era's most consistently lucrative investment. He also served as an unofficial representative of the Canadian government and was made a baronet in 1872. Now, James liked the Rose children. They were his contemporaries, but he kept his distance from the formidable woman he called Aunt Charlotte, refused several invitations to stay with her. For me, the real interest lies in the figure of Sir John Rose, not the historical person, but the man seen in terms of his family position. He's the uncle by marriage to whom Minnie Temple would have gone to visit if she'd ever been well enough to travel abroad. So the situation into which the character Isabel steps, it's surprisingly close in resemblance, a surprisingly close resemblance to one in James's own extended family. Even though as people, the Roses have almost nothing in common with the Touchetts. Family tradition holds that Charles Rose, James's host, he served as the model for Mr. Toad in The Wind in the Willows. The Dictionary of National Biography describes his father, Sir John, as, quote, dying of a heart attack brought on by the excitement of shooting a stag. It's hard to imagine the shrewd but modest Daniel Touchett doing that. As a character, as a temperament, he owes less to Sir John Rose than he does to an American banker named Russell Sturgis, a member of an old Salem, Massachusetts family who in Britain became a director of Barings. James spent some Christmases with them. Their son Howard became one of his closest friends. Now, this hunting for an original might seem just a bit of gossip, except that doing so can tell us something about the way in which Henry James worked. Isabel, we can indeed see as developing out of his cousin. Minnie's the starting point. And yet the great lady whom we see at the end of the novel, she owes very little to the girl spitting blood and dying young. But she's a special case. Looking at Mr. Touchett can show us something else, something closer to James's usual practice. For his character isn't so much a composite as a laminate, which James has glued the temperament of one financier to the family of another. Let me end this piece of my talk by reminding us of the scene into which Isabel steps when she first moves onto that lawn. The men talk companionably. Yet old Mr. Touchett also strikes a curious note, for he announces his belief that there will be great changes, and not all for the better. Now, this is the kind of thing that old men say, and I'm starting to say them myself. They're not something in which we should try very hard to find a social or political meaning. Yet it does tell us something about the novel. It won't be all tea parties. Isabel may see herself as having stepped inside a novel, but not all novels end well. 3, the Villa Castellani. And one of the great things about working on Portrait of a Lady was that I had to go to Italy, where so much of it is set, about 60% of the novel is set in Italy. In fact, I had to go again and again and again. And maybe the saddest thing about finishing my own book was that now I needed to find a new excuse. Since I finished, I've been working on William Faulkner, and I have to tell you, going down to Mississippi is not at all the same thing. So one morning in Florence, I paused at the foot of the Ponte Vecchio and looked back, turning away from the river, for a view of the buildings that faced it. One of them had once been a place called the Hotel dell'Arno, where in an upstairs room, James had sat making Isabel take her first steps. Too much had been rebuilt here, though, for me to even speculate as to which window it was, which building exactly it was. Shrug, walk on. Across the river, past the Palazzo Pitti, past Machiavelli's house, and then on through the old Porta Romana, where the road began to climb. Here the city's fabric loosened, and through heavy gates I had an occasional view of a villa, a mustard-colored building set back in a garden of umbrella pines and olives. As the road climbed, the villas got larger and security more elaborate. Signs warned about dogs, barbed wire ran above the walls that lined the street. The tops of the walls themselves were a bristle of broken glass. If you're an aching alien, James wrote, half the talk is about villas. This one has a story. That one has another. And by now, a lot of those Florentine villas, they have a kind of American twist. In 1858, for example, Nathaniel Hawthorne rented a place called the Torre, the Tower di Montato, on top of Bello Sguardo. It's the hill I was now approaching. For $28 a month, he got a place big enough to quarter a regiment. Later, he used it as a setting in the Marble Faun. My own destination was a place that James had described as a little, grassy, empty, rural piazza, and bounded upon one side by a villa with a long, rather blank-looking front. Now, the grass was gone now, though they didn't keep a boy from kicking a soccer ball against a gate, but the house was still there. Like many such places, it's carried several names. For much of its life, it was called the Belvedere al Saracino. In the 20th century, it became known as the Villa Mercedes, and it did hard time as a finishing school for American girls. James knew it as the Villa Castellani, and some family friends of his had an apartment there. He had known the widowed Frank Boot and his daughter Elizabeth in Newport and Cambridge. Elizabeth was a few years younger than he was. She had been a friend of Minnie Temple as well. Now, Francis Boot had first gone to Italy at mid-century, where he lived on the profits of a Lowell textile mill. He gave himself over to the care and education of his daughter, whom James described as the markedly produced Lizzie. He remembered her as infinitely civilized, a girl toned as from steeping in a rich old medium. This is a portrait of hers by the man she eventually married, and a painter from Cincinnati named Frank Duveneck. But James wrote about the Villa Castellani in three different works, in his 1875 novel, Roderick Hudson, in an 1878 essay called Italy Revisited, and finally in The Portrait of the Lady. In the first of these, he calls it the Villa Pandolfini. It's a building with a long, rather low facade, colored a dull, dark yellow, pierced with windows of various sizes. You can hear how he's repeated the description from one book to another. Inside, the rooms themselves seem as cool as royal sepulchres, while the garden behind swells with figs and olives and offers a prospect to the valley below. It was a place and a view that he never quite learned not to covet, and he loved both the cypresses outside and the sense within of a place dedicated to the love of art and beauty. Now today the building is still painted yellow, yellowish anyway. Its windows remain irregular. Its facade is modest, almost anonymous, and it sits directly on the street. There's no barbed wire, no broken glass here. The gate stood open, and a caretaker waved me into a lichen-covered courtyard. There was a well in one corner, a vespa in another, a few markers for the cemetery, a pet cemetery. I noted the names on the mailboxes of the dozen flats into which the building was now divided. A German, a Scandinavian, and then, of course, a lot of Italians, including somebody named Corleone. There was one English name, a place belonging to a Lawrence of Florence. And one of his Italian travel essays, James describes himself as peeping up the stately staircases of one historic house after another and wishing that he might climb up for a view of the life within, the hidden life that every tourist wants to see. So I'll confess, I paused with my finger over Lawrence's button, wondering just who might appear. But in the end, I had no more courage than James himself. I left that bell unrung. So I've got to rely instead on James's own account of the interior. The description comes in chapter 22 of The Portrait of a Lady, where the book jumps in both time and place. James throws the action 6 months forward and rather suddenly moves us to Italy, introducing some new characters in the process. Here the villa goes nameless, and the language he uses for it has a new figurative power. The building seems incommunicative. Its facade shows not its face, but its mask. It had heavy lids, but no eyes. The place is not what it seems. Its different apartments are mainly occupied by foreigners long resident in Florence. And in one of them, James shows us a room furnished with pieces of tapestry and cabinets of age-polished oak, oddments of medieval brassware and a wall of early masters, and frames pedantically rusty. In this apartment lives a man named Gilbert Osmond. He's a widower of 40, with a father, with a daughter in her teens named Pansy. I won't review the history that James supplies for Osmond or describe Isabel's first visit to that hillside. I won't rehearse the details of the plot in which she's soon ensnared. But James does write that his heroine immediately begins to tell herself a story about a quiet, clever, sensitive, distinguished man strolling on a moss-grown terrace and holding by the hand a little girl. It's the story of a man who has, she believes, made a choice between a shallow life and a serious one. And his studious life in a foreign land, that appears to her inseparable from the widower's half-anxious, half-helpless fatherhood. And this is the man James's heroine will marry. Isabel will make him wait, but a dozen chapters on, she will marry him, and no reader has ever been happy about it. Nobody has ever thought she made a good choice. But it's easy to condemn the match. I think we should try instead to understand it. Keeping with my theme, with the idea of houses, the houses of the fiction, I'm going to try to do it in terms of something another character says, a woman named Madame Merle. Some of you may remember that Edith Wharton's first book was a guide to interior decoration called The Decoration of Houses. She didn't start with a novel. She started by telling us, you know, how to do our rooms. That's something that Gilbert Osmond could give lessons in himself. Your rooms, Madame Merle tells him, are perfect. You understand this sort of thing as no one else does. Osmond isn't rich, but with modest means, he's worked to great effect. And if the Victorians had had shelter magazines, his place would be in them. This sort of thing is an art in itself, a perfectly upholstered daily life. And we have to take it seriously before we can take it lightly. Now, those of you who've read the novel will remember that Isabel unexpectedly inherits £70,000 from her uncle. It's hard to estimate just how much that would be today. Different economists give very different multipliers, anywhere between 30 times and 200 times, depending on whether you look primarily at inflation or at the relative costs of goods and services. The money's left in bank stock, which gave a very good rate of return. It's probably banks, is mostly invested in railroads. And estimates are that she could spend about £5,000 a year, which of course goes much further in Rome than it does in London. Isabel will find the scale of that inheritance a burden. It's embarrassing. It's indelicate to be so rich, so she thinks. But she'll look to good taste itself as a way to redeem it. Good taste, Osmond's taste, that will give her a note of distinction. Something that will go beyond, that will be better than the simple fact of money. And James himself shared her prejudice, even though he also saw through it. He delighted in things old and obscure. His fiction, he makes an eye for them serve as a mark of intelligence. If you've got a good eye for antiques, you're bound to be intelligent in James's world. But he also knew how unsustaining good taste alone might prove. Because that's all that Osmond really has. He's an aesthete, he's got a good eye, but no more. He paints a little, but he's no artist himself. At best, he's a copy of a copy. And of course, no spoiler here, he turns out to be much worse than he seems. He's a man bad enough to have been played by John Malkovich in the movie. But if he were really the kind of man Isabel first takes him to be, he might be attractive. He would then be rather like Frank Booth, the real-life Bostonian in whose apartment James places him, a man who accepts his own limitations and decides to cultivate his own garden. Booth wrote music. He was a serious, though still amateur, composer. He was a more sociable man than Osmond, a very good host, a more genuinely devoted father. His daughter, Lizzie, had tutors in Florence rather than being packed off to a convent school, as Osmond does with his child. Now, that should be enough to caution anyone who might want to claim, as critics sometimes do, that the one family was based upon the other, the Osmonds upon the Boots. Indeed, the difference between them seems so great that it might make us suspect the usefulness of looking for such originals. If the search for some putative original, the model behind a character, that allows us to see what was in fact created. The difference between the page and the gravel of documentary truth, that can stand, as I've suggested, as a guide to artistic practice. Matching the description of the villa in the portrait of a lady, matching that up against an actual walk up that hill, that suggests the degree to which James's Italian settings are indeed traceable to a particular place. But the people he puts in those settings are a different matter. Isabel's an exception, but very, very few of Henry James's other important characters, very few of them have a source in a particular individual person. Or rather, his characters' characters, that is, their moral beings, their personalities, they don't have that source. What James often does, though, is to take not a person, but a set of circumstances from the life around him. In the Villa Castellani, he had an American father, a widower, and an aesthete, who devoted his life to the education of his daughter. That situation planted itself in his brain and waited there until he could use it. Until, quote, an Italian bereft American with a little molded daughter proved exactly what his work required. I had it there, he added. And he had it all the more because Frank Boot had no single note of character or temper in common with my Gilbert Osmond. I see no reason to doubt that claim. What James got from his family friends, what they suggested, what he used, what he could adapt to the tale in his mind, what he got from them was the drama of their position, not that of their particular individual being. Gilbert Osmond is an interesting creation precisely because he differs from the man in whose apartment James placed him. Let me move toward an ending, and do so by returning to the question of windows. Those in Osmond's villa are, James writes, in a regular relation to one another. Oops, that's the courtyard, I'm sorry. There. Their sizes don't match. They aren't evenly distributed as they should be. Not as they should be in a properly proportioned Renaissance building. And in that, they do remind me of the description James would offer many years later of what he called the house of fiction, where all the windows are of a different size and shape. I'd hesitate to suggest that the Villa Castellani is in itself the source of James's imagery, that the language he defines that metaphor has, of course, another source. We can trace his evocation of the million windows of the house of fiction to Christ's words in the Gospel of John, "In my Father's house there are many mansions." Nevertheless, the scale of the house James imagines, so many windows, all giving on to different scenes, all revealing different aspects of the human life outside, that architectural image does owe something to his experience in Italy. He eventually collected his travel essays under the title Italian Hours, and over again in that book, he evokes the spectacle of the Italian palazzo, the Palazzo Strozzi in Florence, say, or the Barbaro in Venice, the Barberini in Rome, houses of an extraordinary size and proportion, and too grand, he says, for ordinary human life. Even in their 19th century decrepitude, these houses speak of an elevation and an extent. They round their great arches and interspace their huge windows with a proud indifference to the cost of materials. Thick of wall, marked by a solidity of staircase and a superfluity of stone, they can exalt the people who live in them. They can give their inhabitants the breadth and the generously proportioned vision of their own rooms and windows. So it is, I think, in the greatest novels of James's day. Reading them exalts us. So it is in this one. It's no accident that in writing about what he had achieved in The Portrait of a Lady, Henry James found his guiding metaphor in the grandest kind of domestic architecture. Thank you. Well, I have to say, it must be this room, because usually I'm much better with a PowerPoint. I get the images up right at the right moment, but not here. I don't know if there's time for questions. I'm happy to take questions if anybody wants to throw anything at me. Yes?
Well, the house is privately owned now, or is it a historical trust or what?
Garden Court is, not Garden Court, Lamb House is National Trust. This one seems to be privately owned in that it's split up into a bunch of apartment buildings, into a bunch of apartments. I don't know if they're condos or what, or who the owner is. Garden Court is owned by the same family that owned it when James visited. The current owner is somebody named Sir Julian Rose, who had an American wife and now seems to have a different one. And as I said, it's the estate is intact. It's about 1,000 acres, though much of that is given over to farming with tenants to do that. Yes?
Yeah. At the start, you talked about James basically trying to rewrite or at least substantially edit
a lot of his work, yeah.
Was that something that other late 19th and early 20th century authors did?
It's excessive. No, he did it much more than most people.
Yeah.
I mean, most people did some revision after they appeared in a magazine. Mm-hmm. Serial version, you clean it up a little bit, maybe you usually expanding it a little bit. James would do that for successive editions, but then this going back over things 25 years later, that's unusual. Nobody else did that.
What do you make of that?
A lot of readers didn't like it. They felt, we knew the book this way, now you get to tell us to buy another one and it's harder to read. He spent, two or three years on this big, great edition and it flopped. And there's still an active debate about which version of the novels to use. I myself think that the later version of Portrait of the Lady is a stronger book than the original one. If the language is richer and more intense. But I used the first version as my copy text for this because I wanted to tell the story of process of how it developed. But it was very unusual, the degree to which he touched things up.
What do you make of what was going through his mind as he was doing that? Was he trying to retell his story, his life story?
Not that. I think there's a Max Beerbohm cartoon from the period in which you have two images of Henry James. There's an older man and there's a young one, and they're each looking at each other. And there's a single word balloon that says, "How badly you write." the young one thinking, "This is excessive." The old one thinking, "I didn't know what I was doing." Sometimes he wanted to fix mistakes. Other things he wanted to do in this edition was he said he wanted to quietly disown some things, stories or that he didn't think came quite up to snuff. He hoped they would sort of die. He made some mistakes in the choices. But the degree of revision was unusual.
Yeah. Is it in Florence or is it in Fiesole?
In Florence.
It's in Florence.
It's in Florence. It's on the south side of the Arno. That was really where, in the mid-19th century, the American colony was in Florence. Fiesole and the other side of the other side of Florence, going up that way towards, say, Villa Itati, is more later 19th century. Yes?
I'm wondering if you've read the book, The Master, by...
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And for everybody else, that's a written in the style of Henry James, about Henry James.
Right.
Being an expert on Henry James, what did you think of that?
Oh, I love The Master.
Portrait of,
yeah, I love The Master. I reviewed it when it came out, and I thought it was a magnificent novel. I mean, but there are moments where Toivonen speculates about things that probably didn't happen, but he makes them believable for the character. I thought it was a really wonderful book. And then a few years later, when my book on James came out, you have a book coming out, you start Googling yourself madly to see if there are any reviews yet. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, Toivonen is reviewing me. And it was the first real review, and I think, am I going to be happy or not? And I stab my iPad, and then he liked it, so I was pleased, but also flattered because I really admire The Master.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. Yeah.
What's your next project?
I'm writing a book about William Faulkner and the Civil War, and it's mostly done, depending on whether my editor.